Little boxes in the archive, little boxes made by Hollinger, little boxes in the archive, little boxes all the same. There's a gray one and a gray one and a gray one and a gray one, and they're all made out of cardboard and they all are acid free.
Are listening to WREK Atlanta, and this is Lost in the Stacks, the acid-free research library rock and roll radio show. I'm Amit, and we're in the studio with Fred, Wendy, Allison, Matthew, and Will. Each week on Lost in the Stacks, we pick a theme and then use it to create a mix of music and library talk. And whichever you're here for, we hope you dig it.
Our show today is called Who Discovered the Archives?
We'll be talking with our colleague, Special Collections Archivist, Allison Reynolds, about discoveries, specifically who discovers what in archives.
As well as the who and what of archives that may be hiding in plain sight.
If a letter sits in an archives box, is it hidden or has an archivist already discovered it? If a tree falls in an archives forest and a researcher isn't there to hear it, does it make a sound?
Whoa. Okay, a few disclaimers before we dig in.
Number one, archives are not dusty.
Number two, archivists are real.
Number three, this episode will include moments of serious troublemaking.
Sounds good. If you want to join the conversation, the hashtag for this show is Lits4134 Lost in the Stacks, episode 413. Feel free to tweet your thoughts, questions, or archival discoveries with that hashtag.
Our songs today are about discovery, invisible labor, and acknowledgement. Oh, and did I mention that this is by Allison's request? All of today's songs are from the 1980s.
Yay!
And you can't get much more 80s than Duran Duran. So let's kick off with a song that also sounds like a question that we were going to ask Allison. This is There Something I Should Know by Duran Duran, right here on Lost in the Stacks.
Please, please tell me now. Please, please tell me now. What it tastes is definitely now. Is there something definitely now?
This is Lost in the Stacks, and we're talking about what's discovered or invisible in archives. Our guest today is Allison Reynolds, Special Collections Archivist in Georgia Tech's Archives and Special Collections. To start, Allison, can you tell us a bit about your background and your role as an archivist here at Georgia Tech?
Yeah, so as Special Collections Archivist, I do a little bit of everything having to do with archives maintenance. I do accessioning, processing, some instruction, reference, outreach, exhibits. So it's kind of front of the house and back of the house. My background has been mostly working with paper, archives, and manuscripts, but I'm going to be looking into the digital world a little bit here at Georgia Tech. And one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about this, at first I saw this article on a Facebook group that I belong to about archival discovery, what constitutes discovery. And one of the things that got me interested in archives is I feel like I get to be the first person to discover a historic document when it comes to the archives. But this article that I found is about Sylvia Plath papers at the Lilly Library at Indiana University. And in January, apparently a researcher found a short story that hadn't been published and got a lot of attention for being the first person to discover it, in quotation marks. But it had actually been cataloged at the Lilly Library for years. The people that worked there knew about it. And so who's really discovered it then? Is it the librarian or the archivist, or is it the person who publishes it? And that's one of the things that we're going to talk about today.
And you brought up another instance of this phenomenon of the media, hyping up discoveries by researchers. It was about the papers of Abraham Lincoln, right?
Yeah. After I read that article about Plath, it had a link to another article from 2012 where a researcher in the National Archives discovered a report about Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's health after he was assassinated. And this person said, nobody knew about this. I discovered it. She got all kinds of national media attention. And then an archivist wrote an article in The Atlantic and said, well, actually, this has been here 100 years. Somebody who worked here as a librarian or archivist made a decision thinking this was important and added to the collection. So it's not really a discovery. And then the researcher published a counter argument saying, actually, it is a discovery. If nobody that works there knows about it, then yes, I found it and it's a discovery. So I feel like there's a little bit of tension there between archivist and researcher and who should take credit for these supposedly big historic documents.
And the another layer of the twist in the Lincoln case was that the researcher, her background was sort of mixed as well, right?
Yeah, it sounded like she was a historian, but also had a library science degree with an archives background. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned that one of the things that draws you to archives is this sense of discovery and the opportunity to discover things. Do you have a stance on who discovers things in archives?
That's a very good question. And I was thinking about that before the show, and I sort of feel like it depends. I want to say if it's described by an archivist and it's online, it's on a finding aid, then definitely an archivist has found it. I've seen situations where a historian comes in and says, look, I found all these letters. And I'm like, actually, that's been online for several years. Like, you're not, you might be the person to notice it, but you didn't discover it.
So as our listeners know, I'm not an archivist, but I admire them greatly. And I think one of the, maybe this is a myth, but maybe it's not. The accessioning process, does it often require you to, are you faced with like a chaotic collection of unorganized boxes, and then the work of the archivist involves organizing, discovering, you know, what's in that collection? Because to me that seems like not unlike discovering like a new chemical, you know, or a new that a chemist might discover in a lab. So maybe take us into that moment where you're faced with uncertainty or chaos, and that might give me a sense of like, here's the moment of discovery.
Yeah, usually you get a box of stuff and it's all jumbled together. And so the archivist's job is to put it in order and do kind of minimum level description just so that people will be able to find it and kind of get a general idea of what's in a box. I think with the National Archives, one of the arguments was that this wasn't at an item level. It was just a whole box. And archivists usually don't have the time to describe every single thing in an item level. And that's where that concept of, well, if the box is described but the item's described, then, you know, is it a discovery or not? But I think that by saying that, it's almost like archivists are hiding things. I don't like that view of like, or just, we don't want you to find things. We're just keeping it in a box and we're hurting it. And we need these researchers to come in and save the document from obscurity. Like, I think that's the wrong kind of attitude to have. But yeah, certainly researchers are helpful in publicizing things that we might not know that we have in archival collections.
What are your thoughts on why we describe in aggregate? Do you think that's ideal? First, you mentioned like how we don't have time to do item level. Do you think we should? Is that the duty of the archivist, like in a fantasy land? Or do you believe in aggregate?
No, I think item level is too much for most collections. I mean, I've seen collections that are largely just receipts or records of people who work somewhere, and it's just not worth the time. But if you do have a collection, you know, where there might be something from Abraham Lincoln, then it might be worth noting that maybe I should take a closer look at this and do some item level description.
Well, we'll be back with more about archival discovery and description after a music set.
File this set under GTA.com. 1098.
Hello. Hello again. Hello. Hello again.
Oh, You just heard It's a Miracle by Culture Club. Before that was Hello Again by The Cars. Those are some songs about discovery and rediscovery.
You are listening to Lost in the Stacks, and today we're talking about what discovery means in the context of archives with our archivist colleague and guest, Allison Reynolds. So Allison, when we're thinking about discovery, people coming into the archives to discover things, some archivists feel that the work that enables that discovery is invisible. Can you talk about like what invisible labor is and why archivists might think of this as invisible labor?
I think when you're a researcher and you've been working in archives, you know, you kind of expect that you're going to come in and you're going to receive a box and it's going to be in some kind of order. It's going to be in folders and organized. And that's all the work that the archivists do behind the scenes is actually appraising it, deciding what to keep and what, you know, doesn't need to be kept and putting it in folders so that it's preserved, that sort of thing. So it's all those things that happen, you know, months, years before a researcher comes in that I think the researcher kind of just takes for granted.
It's not like the notion, like we were talking during the break about the notion of Indiana Jones. People will come into the archives and think like having like an Indiana Jones mindset, like, oh, I'm in this, you know, territory to dig through. But in real life, archaeologists go out to some, you know, point and just like start to, you know, dig. Maybe something's there, something's not. There's actually a lot of effort that's been put into this place where you're coming in and saying, okay, Indiana Jones, dig here and look through our finding aids to get your thing.
Right. I mean, when you're doing research, what you're essentially looking at has kind of been curated by the archivist already. You're not necessarily seeing the raw materials like you are in an archaeology site. But I think there's still a lot to discover there. I mean, as we said before, we don't always describe at the item level. So I think a lot of researchers come in and they are looking for that smoking gun, something that the archivist maybe missed during their processing and something that maybe nobody else has seen before.
So to what extent do you think archivists are complicit in being invisible? Like, do you think this is something that we encourage through our behavior of, you know, leave no trace?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think that's something people have been talking about a lot in the archives world. I feel like maybe we don't always do the best job of publicizing things. We kind of, you know, put things in order and put a finding aid up online, a document people can search, and then feel like our job is done and that's it. Plus, I know we create, you know, grants and things like Hidden Collections Grant, digitizing hidden collections, all those things that are sort of just enforcing that stereotype.
So I want to bring back something that you just said, Wendy, and I think we may have mentioned this in previous archive shows, but that archivist ethos of leave no trace. Can you and Allison talk a little bit about what that is and like how that feeds into the invisibility myth of archival work?
Yeah, I mean, you talked a little bit about how, you know, the work that archivists do, refoldering things, going through things, doing appraisal, but also it seems like underlying that, there's this impulse towards honoring the original order of something, or, you know, metaphorically using white gloves so that you don't leave any impact on the archives and you present them as they were created to the researcher. Do you, when you're doing, say, accessioning or processing, do you aim to leave a trace and be visible in that process? Or do you aim to sort of maintain, steward things without leaving your mark?
Yeah, I mean, the original order, that's one of the concepts they always teach you right away when you're studying archives. And I know collecting is kind of inherently biased. It's difficult to keep your bias out when you're getting collections. But, you know, that's the thing. If there is no order, how can people find things? You know, if there's absolutely no original order, then yeah, you do try to, you know, put things in an order, but keeping to some of the standards. I mean, we have the Society of American Archivists standards for arrangement description. So I think that's one way we try to make a mark without leaving a mark. We try to put things in order without, you know, showing our own bias.
In the break, we were talking a little bit about moments of discovery that you've had in the archives. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about some of those? And I guess, how did you behave? Did you leave a mark where you had made a discovery? Would a researcher know that you had discovered those things?
We were talking about some of the weirdest things I had found in the archive, and I mentioned there was this, in my last job, there was a scrapbook with baby teeth in it from the early 20th century. And it was actually a student working on a project who found it and told me about it. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that's probably not going to make it in national news. But I don't think I put that in the finding aid. I was doing a lot of really detailed description for that collection. So things like hair. I did find a piece of hair, and I did add a note that there was hair in this letter because it was commemorating somebody's death. But no, I think for something like that, it didn't. But if somebody had, you know, we found a letter from Abraham Lincoln that we didn't know about, then that we would definitely want to make a note about.
Yeah. And that goes to sort of like what we make judgments about, what is worth noting as a discovery, right? Like mm-hmm. a baby teeth might be so significant to the mother of the baby, but it's not a famous baby maybe. So, you know, these ideas of what is worth discovering, yeah. I guess.
Well, somebody somewhere along the line decided it was worth keeping the baby teeth in the scrapbook. So that was even an appraisal decision if they knew about it.
The hair that you found, it wasn't from Abraham Lincoln, was it?
No.
That might change the interest level.
Exactly. I might have got interviewed by Time magazine then.
So you've done accessioning, you've done processing, you've, as you said, been involved in sort of many stage and outreach, many stages of this work of that is sometimes seen as invisible. What do you find most gratifying? Do you enjoy being visible? Or what do you find personally where you feel like you're making the most impact?
Yeah, I think all of this is linked to outreach too. You know, we sometimes think about the work we do as being kind of dichotomous, like behind the scenes processing and then front of the house, you know, outreach and instruction. But I really think those two things are really inextricably linked. And that's something that we can do to try to make our work more visible. But when you ask what I find gratifying about it, I think it is more promoting the materials. And if, you know, in the past 10, 20 years, that's really been a big push in archives profession too. So I think for decades, people were just keeping things behind locked doors, being gatekeepers. We are definitely trying to move away from that. And that's why I really enjoy when I can do things with the community or do things with students and have classes come in and show them weird things. You know, I remember my last job pulling letters like that and telling people about the hair, and they always think it's weird. And those are the kinds of things that they remember about the archives, and it makes it seem a little more accessible.
Well, we'll return to our discussion about weird things and what's visible and invisible in archives on the left side of the hour.
Hello, good people. You are Lost in the Stacks with Ian MacKay here on WREK in Atlanta.
This episode of Lost in the Stacks is called Who Discovered the Archives? In January of this year, Bethany Anderson, university archivist at the University of Virginia, wrote in The Conversation, quote, "Another reason these tropes persist could have to do with the way our society privileges innovators over maintainers. Maintainers, according to scholars Andrew Russell and Lee Vinsel, are those individuals whose work keeps ordinary existence going rather than introducing novel things." That's a quote. Archivists are maintainers. They perform the, quote, ordinary work of acquiring, appraising, and arranging archival materials. They respond to the inquiries of students and researchers and work to preserve materials for posterity. As members of the archival community have pointed out, this sort of work is generally ignored and misunderstood. Instead, when it comes to stories about archival research, stories will focus on the innovators, the scholars who write about the rare manuscript or old letter, and in doing so, rescue these materials from obscurity. In almost every case, these stories gloss over the fact that these items exist in publicly accessible collections and are described in finding aids and databases. End quote. While you ponder what's visible and invisible, file this set under 2019-001.
That was Sideshow by Wendy and Lisa, a bop about working hard and being acknowledged for it.
Welcome back to Lost in the Stacks. I feel like I need to go to jazzercise after all of this music. I'm feeling good. Today we're talking about what is discovered and overlooked in archives. So Allison, we've talked a little bit about the sense of discovery that archivists experience, the sense of discovery that researchers experience or claim, as well as some of the maybe labor issues underlying that visibility or invisibility of archival work. Do you see any potential solutions, I guess, to this problem? To what extent do you think this is a problem, that researchers claim to discover things or archivists claim to discover things? Is this something that we need to solve?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to be acknowledged for the work that we do. I mean, I think, you know, when the archives fail, it's a sign of the apocalypse. It's at least a societal breakdown. But yeah, it is a little bit of a problem only because I think that we are not great at advocating for ourselves. We kind of see this as like our public service and, you know, our part is to do this, and it's separate to do this being the arrangement, description, gathering, and it's the researcher's part to do the publishing. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think we can kind of get ahead of the curve, and it's a little bit easier to do when we have new collections coming in. I mean, nowadays, outreach is such an important part, and lots of institutions will have people that all they do is outreach archivists. But, you know, we have blogs, we have social media. If we get a collection coming in, even before it's processed, like as we're accessioning, get a box, snap a photo, and put it on your Facebook page or put it on a blog, local, national, if you don't have your own, and get it out there that, like, hey, we have this really cool thing, and then you get credit for finding it, and it also will tell other people that they can come in and research. You know, you still might have the problem that Indiana had where somebody has published on something, but somebody still, you know, comes in and claims to have found it. Like, my mom would always say, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. But it can't hurt for us to you know, reach out a little bit more to communications, university communications, and is a good starting point, and then just see where it goes from there.
One of the pieces we were looking at before the show is a piece by the archivist Stacey Williams on Medium, her blog on Medium, and she says, how best can we challenge our repositories to change this? It's not all hopeless. We can build more equitable salaries into our grant proposals that bridge gender, racial, and living wage gaps. We can accept that true archival practice means paying professionals for their time and quality, and that pay that may mean we can't clear as many backlogs or even using an MPLP standard. So thinking about how the very sort of ethics that we bring to our employment practices, acknowledging ourselves within the profession that this work is visible and must be equitable, is like a whole other layer within our field too. There's like these different layers, it seems, of like to each other we need to be validating and advocating for ourselves. And then to the wider world, to the media, the press, we need to be perhaps squeakier wheels.
Yeah. That's And it doesn't even have to be like to meet either, just within our own institutions. You know, we can digitize things now. And, you know, if we have it, then we put it on our website, at least, you know, we've shown that we found it before a researcher, and then it can, you know, be out for researchers from other places to find too.
How common is it for archivists to be in the acknowledgments of papers that are written in, like, you know, say a history journal, for example? Is that a common practice or a norm?
I think so. Like where I was working before, we had a lot more really influential 19th century collections, like Susan B. Anthony, Frederick Douglass, and really big in women's suffrage. So we had a lot of people come in and write books, and they would put in the preface to their book, like, thank you to this archivist. I think I've even mentioned in a book when I was in grad school, I was helping someone research sports history at Indiana University. And I think I Google searched myself, like you do sometimes, and I showed up in the acknowledgments for this book, and I didn't even remember helping the person. So I feel like that is helpful. You know, it's nice, a nice gesture, and I think it does happen if the person is doing long-term research somewhere.
What role do you think, another thing that you and I talked about was a piece by former Society of American Archivists President Tanya Zonish Belcher on the Off the Record blog about this visibility problem. What role do you think professional organizations might play in discovering visibility of archival labor as a solution, maybe?
Yeah. Oh. I don't know. That's a loaded question. you know, they're all the time creating standards. You know, they've got standards for description, standards for, you know, metrics of public services and instruction standards. So maybe, I don't know that we need another set of standards for advocacy, but, you know, certainly support. I mean, I've gone to SA every year the past few years, and there's always sessions about advocacy and outreach. And I think there's an essay workshop about archival advocacy, and that tends to have more about asking for money, though, asking for money and staff support.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point about standards. And there was interesting changes going on with the descriptive standard, the DAX standard, and sort of trying to place archivists to be more visible in that standard and be a little more transparent about the decisions that we make when we describe materials. I guess when you're creating description, do you think about, would your impulse be to put your name on the finding aid as the author? Or would your impulse be to be transparent about some of the decisions that you're making and describing materials?
I like when people put their names on finding aids. I notice a lot of places don't do that, but I think it's great to just show all the work you've done, and B, also it tells people who to get in touch with if they have questions. Typically the person who processed the collection knows more about it than anybody else anywhere. And then, you know, for chain of command, I mean, I know collections that we had that from the 1980s, and people haven't worked there in 20 years, and you don't know who made it. And so if their name is on there, at least you kind of can look back, you know, in the documentation previous years. We had a librarian who had retired like 20 years ago at Rochester, and we still would email him all the time because he had all this institutional knowledge and his name was on everything. So yeah, I think it's important that you be acknowledged for your work. And was that in the standard? Were they advocating to put people's names on finding aids or no?
I don't think it mentioned that specifically, but sort of emphasizing more that we should say, if we're leaving something out, why we've left it out in the description. It seems like it was moving more in that direction, and that we should be more user-centered and more aware of our direct relationship with the user. But yeah, I've always thought, I love it when the name is in a finding aid, because I want that person to get credit.
Yeah.
It actually reminds me a little bit about music and music producers. In many cases, it seems like music producers who work with artists are as acknowledged or even more acknowledged than the artists themselves, like Brian Eno, for example, you know, or Rudy Van Gelder in jazz is a legendary producer who kind of created the conditions for great music to happen, but it was very much a partnership. So Yeah, I'm down with that, the Wendy standard. I'm going to call it the Wendy standard.
I'm curious, Fred and Amit, as non-archivists perhaps, although at this point maybe you're becoming archivists with all, through all these all right. shows.
I would love to be an honorary archivist.
Do you feel like this visibility thing applies to library work as well? Do you see this happening?
What occurred to me when you were talking about things like, you know, putting your name on a finding aid, it brought back some other discussions that we've had on the show about neutrality and cataloging. When a finding aid is created, it's not just, you know, a listing of the facts. Somebody is creating that. Somebody that is operating in some system is creating that. So put your name on it. You know, the archivist is doing, you know, an admirable job, I'm sure, but, you know, the fact is that nothing is neutral and created in a vacuum. So I would, you know, welcome seeing, you know, names on it. That's just, you know, kind of acknowledging, yeah, we're in a system.
Well, we only scratched the surface, but hope to revisit this topic again soon on Lost in the Stacks. We've been speaking to Allison Reynolds, Special Collections Archivist in Georgia Tech's Archives and Special Collections. Allison, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back after a music break.
File the set under 1984-0601. You just heard Back on the Chain Gang by The Pretenders. Before that was Walking in L.A. by The Missing Persons. Two songs about the important things that are hidden from view until you look a little closer.
Today's show is called Who Discovered the Archives? And in an effort to illuminate what we believed to be all too often going unseen, let's talk about some of the invisible labor that we've discovered on our own during our past weeks at the Georgia Tech Library, which is now partially renewed. So the renewed Crosland Tower. Wendy, do you want to start?
Sure. Yeah, I guess I just want to give a shout out to as Amit mentioned, we moved into what feels like a new building, a renewed building, and we have this retro lab with some old video game consoles, and everything is secured behind these shutters. It's like this amazing furniture thing that to secure them. Anyway, it's like super complicated to lock and unlock these shutters. So I want to give a shout out to the security team in the library who has helped me. I cannot tell you how many times locking and unlocking 5 different locks on these shutters. It's just like you'd never think about that being part of what makes the library tick, but it's been really important to me.
Yeah, shout out to the security team. There's also this week there have been foxes roaming campus, so shout out to the security team for keeping the library fox free. We don't want rabid foxes running through the stacks.
That is a good way to end this segment and this show.
Is it?
Yeah. Will, let's take us out.
Lost in the Stacks is a collaboration between WREK Atlanta, the Georgia Tech Library, and the Georgia Tech Library, produced by Charlie Bennett, Amit Doshi, Wendy Hagenmeyer, and Fred Rasko.
And Will was our engineer today. The show was brought to you by The Collective, a library conference designed to create collaborations with next-generation academic librarians, archivists, and library staff.
They're on the web at thelibrarycollective.org, where you can see the program for this year's conference and learn more about how the collective pursues its goals.
Legal counsel and the infinite secrets buried in all the world's Hollinger boxes were provided by the Burris Intellectually... Let me do that again. Legal Counsel, and The Infinite Secrets Buried in All the World's Hollinger Boxes, all of them, were provided by the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Special thanks to Allison for being on the show, and thanks, as always, to each and every one of you for listening.
Find us online at lostinthestacks.org, and you can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and plenty of other places we don't know about.
Next week on Lost in the Stacks, we're talking libraries in fiction.
It's time for our last song. Fred, I'm looking at this song you've got queued up.
Oh, yeah.
Does it really sum up today's themes of archivists and invisible labor and good troublemaking?
Well, we've been playing all songs from the 80s, and it's a song from the 80s, so that's about as far as I got to matching it to today's theme. Sorry. It's an awesome song to start the weekend, right?
Hey, yeah. That's what it's all about.
Rediscovering the 80s.
That works for me. This is Word Up by Cameo right here on Lost in the Stacks. Have a great weekend, everybody. Word up.